Welcome to the sixth episode of the Meet the Mancunian podcast, season two. The Meet the Mancunian podcast takes you on a weekly journey around the local community in Manchester. Season two has an interesting lineup of inspiring guests making a social or community impact in the city. Presented by Deepa Thomas Sutcliffe, newbie Mancunian. Tune in every Tuesday for your weekly dose of inspiration. Looking to support the HIV positive? In this episode, we hear from Paul Fairweather. Paul is an LGBT and HIV campaigner, and he works for George House Trust. So I'm delighted to introduce my guest, Paul Fairweather, an LGBT and HIV campaigner. Thank you, Paul, for joining me today.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
How did you find your passion for campaigning for LGBT and HIV, Paul? Tell us about that.
I mean, I was born in 1956, and it's the 50th anniversary of actually coming out. So I came out, first started going on the gay scene in Liverpool when I was 16. So in those days, it was completely hidden. For gay men, it was illegal till 1967. And when I was at school, there was no information about being gay at all. So it's only when I left home and went to college that I came out and got more involved in campaigning. And for me, I suppose a key influence was the Gay Liberation Front. The Gay Liberation started in 1969 in New York after the Stonewall riots. And in 1971, a group was set up in London. And there was a book called The Gay Liberation Book, which is a selection of essays written by a whole range of different people about being lesbian and gay and about gay oppression. And I read those books when I was 18, and it had a big impact on me. And then a few years later, I met in London, I met some of the people involved in Gay Liberation Front. So since then, I've been involved in campaigning in a whole range of different ways. And I came to Manchester in 1978 to work for the Campaign for Homosexual Equality, which was then the main gay rights organisation in this country, a bit like Stonewall today, but it just had one full-time member of staff, that was me. So I stayed in Manchester and then went on to work at what was then Manchester Lesbian and Gay Centre. And whilst I was working there, I helped set up a magazine for gay men called Mancunian Gay, and we began to read about this strange new disease in America called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, that was beginning to affect small groups of gay men in New York and Los Angeles. So I began writing about that, and then in 1984, I organised a public meeting in the gay village, and a guy called Tony Whitehead came, who'd just been involved in the Terence Higgins Trust, and made the most prophetic speech about how HIV and AIDS was going to affect the whole community. So following that meeting, myself and five other gay men set up Manchester AIDS Line as a telephone helpline, which became the George House Trust. So actually I've been involved with the George House Trust since the very beginning, and I was one of the people who helped set it up.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing this deep relationship that you've had with these areas for such a long time, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of change and observed a lot more, hopefully, openness to talking about this. Like you just said, you're just doing school awareness, which is great, and I think that's the right time to start talking to people. So anything that you want to talk about from what you've observed, and what would you say in 2022 was the most pressing concerns, either for the subject of LGBT or for HIV?
I think on both issues, I think there's been enormous changes in terms of LGBT rights, both in terms of legislation. When I was growing up, you could lose your job for being gay. You could be denied services. There was no gay marriage. So now we've got almost complete legal equality. And there's been massive change in public attitudes. Again, when I was growing up, no one was openly lesbian or gay. These days, there's a whole range of models and people open about the sexuality or their gender identity. I still think it can be difficult if you're in a small town, if you suffer more than one form of discrimination. I think there's issues for disabled LGBT people, for BME LGBT people, for people in small towns, basically. But I think there has been an enormous change. And I think what we've seen recently is also issues for trans people, lots of discrimination, hatred against trans people. And again, I think it reminds me what happened in the early days for lesbians and gay men, a lot of ignorance, a lot of hostility and stigma. So I still think there's a lot to do in terms of educating people. about LGBT people in general. And also, I think the work that happens in with young people in schools is really important. And with regard to HIV, again, there have been massive changes in HIV. I was diagnosed in 2000, so I've been living with HIV for 22 years. And when I was first diagnosed, I took about 20 tablets a day, some at night, some with food, some without food. So lots and lots of medication. And I now take one tablet a day. My health is fine. My life expectancy is fine. So again, there's been a huge change in the treatment and also in the public attitude. I think people are more aware about HIV and AIDS. In the early 1980s, there was a lot of fear and ignorance and paranoia. And I remember well when Princess Diana went to an AIDS hospital and hugged people, shook their hands and shared coffee with them. That made a huge difference and begin to change people's attitudes, I think. And nowadays, I think for people living with HIV, the key thing is the U equals U message, the undetectable equals untransmittable. So 95% of people in this country have what's called an undetectable viral load. So there's a tiny, tiny amount of the virus in my body, but actually I can't transmit it. I can't infect anybody at all. So in terms of HIV transmission, we are the safest people you could meet. So I think that's really important for those of us living with HIV, that we know we cannot transmit the disease to anybody else. And I think that's really significant. And a lot of people living with HIV, although their health might be fine, they suffer from quite a lot of stigma or isolation or self-stigma. So again, the work that we do, educating young people, educating doctors and health professionals, educating anyone who wants to listen, I think that makes a big impact in encouraging people to have much more awareness of HIV.
Well, I just want to pick up on a couple of things you said. To me, what it seems like, there's a bit of cycles, right? So like you said, in the past, maybe this was about LGBT, today it may be about trans or other forms of identity or sexual identity. And then with HIV, there's been again a lot of medical progress and it's been a lot more awareness, a lot more role models because more famous people are coming out and sharing that they have it. So that's things. But to some extent, a lot of the, it doesn't seem like people are discriminating. It's almost like people are ignorant. And if that ignorance is bridged, then, you know, there's a lot more acceptance. Is that correct?
I think that's true. I think a lot of young people that I talk to, they're really shocked when I talk about discrimination against gay people in the 70s and 80s. I think they're much more aware. They've got much greater access to information. So I think it's very much around giving people the information. And I think in general, there's a lot more openness. People are much more likely to know somebody who's LGBT. They're much more likely to have been aware of issues around HIV. So I think it's much better. There's a much more open society. And I think that's been a massive change in a relatively short period of time. You know, it's like in the last 50 years. It's not a long time in historical terms, but there's been huge amounts of progress, both on LGBT rights and on issues around HIV as well.
That is very interesting. Can you tell us about your work with George House Trust? It's very interesting that you were associated right from the beginning. So maybe talk about what you did earlier as well as what you're now focused on. It'd be very interesting. Sure.
In the very earliest days, we just ran a telephone helpline and met for a few hours a week. And most of the people we talked to were what called the worried well, who were people who were really scared of contracting HIV, but at absolutely no risk. And over time, we began to support more people who were living with HIV. And in those early days, there was no treatments, there was no medication. So actually, a lot of young, healthy people contracted HIV and they died very quickly, really, because there was no treatments. And it's only later on when the medication, the combination therapy came in, that began to change that. So in the early days, we supported a lot of family and friends. We had a buddying system for people. We did a lot of training and education. We gave information about safe sex and prevention. So I think that's what we've done. Nowadays, we provide a whole range of services for people who are newly diagnosed. We can give them a lot of one-to-one support. We run a group for newly diagnosed people, but we've also got groups for women, for African people, for gay men. We've got a great peer mentoring project, which is people living with HIV, supporting other people. 50% of the people we see are refugees and asylum seekers, so we do a lot of work with them. We have a food bank, we have a welfare fund. So actually, we deal with a whole range of people and provide a lot of support. And the Positive Speakers Project I'm involved in, I work with a great group of volunteers, and we basically run HIV awareness training based around our own experiences of living with HIV. And we talk to a whole range of groups. In particular, we've been talking to young people in schools in Manchester, and also to GP and health and social care professionals in Manchester as well.
Very interesting that you'd go to healthcare professionals as well. Is it because they think that they need the support to treat their patients, or they have the right information and support sources to give them patients?
It's a mixture of things. Some of the GPs in Manchester, we've done a joint presentation with some of the HIV consultants. So they'll give a medical update of the latest issues, but then we give the patient's perspective. And I think it's often really important for people to listen to patients as well. So it's not only about the medication, it's about the wider social implications. And we encourage GPs to make sure they refer people to George House Trust. And when we run the training, it's not only for doctors, it's for nurses and receptionists and admin staff. I think it's really important that everyone working in the practice is aware of HIV and the issues around it and some of the support that's available.
That's really interesting. And so the positive speakers are then the volunteers that go to do these sessions. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Very interesting. What challenges are you facing today? I know that you must have had many to overcome over these 50 years, but if you look at 2022 or let's say 2021 onwards, what are the key challenges that you're facing in your campaign?
I think it was quite difficult for many people during COVID. I think a lot of people, if you're isolated anyway, if you're feeling stigmatized, a lot of people lack that sort of face-to-face social support that they had. So it's been quite hard for people, though we were running some sessions online, which I think for some people is quite useful, but other people miss that face-to-face contact. So I think we're doing that. I think there's the key thing for us is to get the U equals U message across, because I think if you're living with HIV, people can self-stigmatize. They can be worried that if they cut themselves, they can infect other people. So my experience is that the more people are open about their HIV status, the more powerful they feel. So when you're first diagnosed, you need to say, are you going to tell your friends, your employees, your family? If you're single, any potential partners? I think there's lots of issues that people need to face. And I think it's important that people get the support to do that. Because although the medical situation is very, very different, the drugs now are very effective. 95% of people living with HIV in this country are undetectable, but there's still a handful of people who get a very late diagnosis and might go on to develop AIDS. So that's still an issue sometimes. And we're also really keen to encourage people to have an HIV test. You can have a test, you can order it online, you can go to your GP, you can go to your sexual health clinic. And again, people who might be at risk of HIV, we would really encourage them to have a regular test, because if they do that, they can be put on medication. And, you know, these days it's very much a manageable condition, but people need to know their status. If they don't have a test, people can live for many years being HIV positive, still being well, so they don't know they're living with HIV. So it's really important that people have an HIV test if they think they might be at risk.
Sharing that. So can you tell us a little bit more about this U equals U message? Can you elaborate on that in a very simple way for listeners around the world who maybe have different contexts?
Sure, exactly, yeah. So in the last 4 or 5 years, they've done a lot of research and they've looked at thousands of couples, one of whom is HIV negative and one of whom is HIV positive, but is undetectable. So when you first get a diagnosis, your viral load, which is how much of the virus in your body. When I was first diagnosed in 2000, my viral load was 750,000. So there were 750,000 bits of the virus in my body. And if you're undetectable, it's less than 50. So there's a tiny, tiny amount of the virus in my body. If I stop taking my medication, that would grow back and eventually I will become ill and go on to develop AIDS and probably die. But at the moment it's there. And because the amount of the virus in the body is so small, if my blood directly goes into someone else's blood, it cannot infect them. So that's been absolutely proven beyond doubt. So that's called undetectable viral load. And every time I go and see my doctor, I get a test and it comes back. So I saw my consultant on Wednesday and my viral load was undetectable still. So the U equals U message is, if you've got an undetectable viral load, it's untransmittable. So you can't transmit the virus to anybody. So in terms of HIV, in terms of anyone becoming infected with HIV, I'm the sort of safest person you can meet. People might assume they're HIV negative, but they might have been infected. And actually, if they've not had an HIV test, they might be very infectious. People might have had an HIV test, but it was 6 months ago, it was a year ago. So they might have become infected by there. But U equals U is just very simply that basically the overwhelming majority of people living with HIV can't infect anybody else. And I think in the past, it's been that fear of contracting HIV, even when there's no evidence from that, that's made people really stigmatize other people. I mean, HIV is very different from COVID. It's a really difficult virus to catch. It dies very, very quickly outside the body. It can only be transmitted in certain ways from mother to baby. Although in this country, every woman who's pregnant has an HIV test. And if she's positive, she'll be given medication. So her baby will be born negative. It can be contracted through unprotected sex, whether that's heterosexual sex or gay sex. And it can be contracted by sharing needles if you're an injecting drug user. But it's very specific the ways it can be contracted. So actually, it's quite important that people are aware of that. If there might be a risk, they have regular HIV tests, but also to be aware of this, you know, new piece of information that actually the people living with HIV cannot transmit the virus to anybody else.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what impact would you say you've made so far?
I mean, I think for me, as I say, it's 50 years since I first sort of came out as gay and got involved in gay places. There's been an enormous change in, I think, visibility. I think for young people growing up now, there's LGBT youth groups, some schools have LGBT support groups. They will see politicians, pop stars, famous people, actors open about their sexuality and about their gender identity. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, I'm from Birkenhead in Merseyside, I generally thought I was the only person in the world who ever felt like this. There was no information at school and there were no positive role models. So I think that's been a huge difference. And the fact that most people will now know someone who's LGBT, I think that's made a huge difference. And that's because many, many activists over many generations have been campaigning and lobbying and talking to people. So I think that's made a big difference. And similarly with HIV, again, when in the earliest days of the epidemic, we didn't know what caused HIV, we didn't know how it was transmitted. And it's only with the combination therapy, the medication that people take now, which is very effective. So it's come from being a disease that basically was a life-threatening condition to now a perfectly manageable condition, and the treatments are improving all the time. And I think the change in attitudes, so the social stigma is probably much less than it was in the 1980s and 1990s, which is why I think the work that we're doing talking to young people is really important. If we can talk to every young person in Manchester, give them information about HIV and give them an opportunity to talk to someone living with the virus and answer questions, I think that will really begin to change people's attitudes and their awareness.
It's wonderful work that you're doing, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you've made a huge impact over these 50 years. Emma shared some of the amazing things that you've done, which was very interesting. So how can interested people reach out to you and learn more, both for yourself as well as from a George House Trust perspective? Where can they find you?
George House Trust is simply, if you Google George House Trust, go onto our website. There's lots of information on our website. If people are living with HIV, they can make a referral themselves, or a GP or health professional can refer someone. And if someone wants to find more information, do get in touch with us. We'd run a lot of training information. We'll provide a lot of one-to-one support for people who found out they're living with HIV. But we also work with their families and friends. And so we're actually, anyone affected by HIV, we're very happy to support them.
How can they reach you, Paul, if they want to specifically reach out to you?
If they want to specifically, if they're interested in the Positive Speakers Project, they can simply email me, which is paul@ght.org.uk. So do send me an email. And I say we're really keen to talk to a whole range of different organisations about the work that we do and about our experiences of living with HIV.
And can I ask if you're also on social media, Twitter or...
Yes, I mean, GHT is very much, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we've got a Facebook page, so do contact us on social media as well, really.
What advice would you have for somebody looking to do something similar and maybe in another part of the world?
I think it's great to learn from what we're doing here. In many parts of the world, the situation is still very different. One of our positive speakers, she came from Kenya, she was diagnosed in Kenya, and when she was there, she would sometimes go to get a medication and it wasn't available. There was a real issue with medication not being available. It's much better than it was in the past, but still in some parts of the world, the medication isn't available, the support isn't available. So I think it's about encouraging local grassroots support, both around HIV and AIDS, but also about LGBT issues. In many parts of the world, there is not legal equality. LGBT people discriminated against or attacked. So there's a lot of issues in terms of supporting both LGBT people, but also people living with HIV across the world, really. But I think in my experience, it's those local grassroots organisations that don't need necessarily a huge amount of resource or paid staff, but it's volunteers who are from the local communities talking to their friends and neighbours and actually just being involved in things. So that can make a huge difference over a period of time, I think.
That, Paul. Switching gears to my signature questions now. So you said you came to Manchester a very long time ago. So why Manchester and, you know, what brought you to Manchester and why do you stay?
I came to Manchester in 1978 because I said I got offered this job for the campaign for homosexual equality. But I'm from the Northwest, I'm from Birkenhead. And I was living in London at the time and I really didn't want to move back to the Northwest. But when I got offered this job, I was told it would be for 6 weeks and they were moving to London. So I remember telling people, I've got this great job, but I've got to go to Manchester for 6 weeks. I don't want to spend 6 weeks in Manchester. And this was 44 years ago. So I'm still here. And I think what Manchester is for me, I do think it's the people are very friendly. Manchester's also got a great tradition of progressive politics or the suffragettes. A lot of the key reform for gay rights came from Manchester. So there's a real tradition. And I think in Manchester, for a long time, we've got a very supportive city council, there's a very supportive community, there's a gay village. So I think if you're LGBT, Manchester is a great place to live, really.
That is really good. And I think I'm hearing that from all my guests. I'm brand new to the city, so
right, great.
I'm always trying to learn more about Manchester, and it's great to meet people like you. Where's your favourite place in Manchester?
My favourite place in Manchester now is... a place called Blakely Forest, which is just around the corner from where I live. And during the pandemic, I just started walking and exploring places. And I've actually lived in North Manchester for 12 years, and I never knew that this place was around the corner, and it's a forest and it's a lake and it's really beautiful. And in the warm weather in the pandemic, I was walking there every day. So I've discovered lots of places to walk, actually, particularly in North Manchester. So for me, that's a local place, which I didn't know about at all. So for me, it's one of the positive outcomes from the pandemic is finding a really beautiful place to walk just around the corner from where I live, really.
Amazing. And yeah, some really lovely country parks, but I don't think I've been to Blakely. Is it Blakely Woods?
Blakely Forest. It's a small forest with a lake. It's a really beautiful, hidden away, right in the centre of North Manchester, really.
Wow. I have to put it on our list. We've got dogs. I'm sure they'd love to go. So what's the most important life lesson you've learned in all your years?
I think for me that I've learned that sometimes the fear of coming out, whether it's about your sexuality or gender identity or HIV status, that is much more damaging than actually the consequences of coming out. I would really encourage people to say that actually you might think the worst things will happen, but in reality, my experience, both around being gay and being HIV positive, the more open I've been about it, the more support that I've got. And I know that can be quite hard for people, but I think I've found that being able to be yourself, truly yourself, is really, really important and gives you so much power in a way. I think that's really important that people are able to do that, really.
And what if somebody wrote a book on your life, what would they title it?
I think they'd call it something like Zest for Life, because as well as all my political activity, I've got lots of other interests. I sort of play the clarinet and piano, I'm singing a choir, I dance, I do lots and lots of activities. Apart from politics, which I think is really important to have like a rounded personality. And I say I've got a great zest for life and living and people, really. So I think I'd call it that.
I like that very much. An opportunity for you to tell us about anything that's coming up or anything that I didn't ask you about.
I mean, I was saying, I think for me, it's having those pleasures. I'm in a clarinet choir, I'm in a wind orchestra. And I think for me, being able to do that and to do it in a situation where I'm open about who I am, I think that's really important. When I was younger, in my sort of 20s, it was a lot of sort of gay, I spent a lot of time with gay people, which was fine. But actually now I have a much wider range of friends and interests. And I think for me, that's much more enjoyable, really. So yes, that's one thing. Really.
Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you anyway. Take care then.
Paul, thank you for talking to me and my listeners. Thank you all for listening from so many countries around the globe. I'm so glad to know you're finding some inspiration from the amazing Mancunian guests who feature here. Please do consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. I would also be grateful if you could share this podcast with a friend or a family member. Thank you so much for your support.